Bienvenidos, amigas y amigas. This is Ernesto Aguilar on Sexto Sol. That was La Bruja, brand new music on the program. And we have a wonderful guest calling us live this evening from Califas. I'm going to go ahead and give him a very, very brief introduction. Our guest again is Jorge Mariscal. Jorge is grandson of Mexican immigrants from the state of Sonora. In 1968, he was drafted into the U.S. Army and served in Vietnam the following year. Today, he is a professor of Chicano and Spanish literature and director of the Chicano Latino Arts and Humanities Program at the University of California in San Diego. In addition, Jorge is the editor of the first anthology of Chicano-Chicano writings on the Vietnam War. The book is called Aslan in Vietnam, Chicano and Chicano Experiences in the War at the University of California Press, 1999. He's also an active member of Project Llano, a group of activists and military veterans who oppose militarism in the public schools, militarization of the border, and the militarization of U.S. society in general. Jorge, I don't know how, that's a very long introduction. How are you doing this evening?
Really good, Ernesto. Gracias. Thanks for having me on.
How is everything going in Califas this evening?
Well, Califas is gearing up for a large anti-war rally in East Los Angeles this Sunday. We're following the exact same route that was marched on August 29th, 1970. So we're expecting a lot of gente to show up for that.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, I definitely want to break it down with you a little bit later on about the current war situation, but I also need people to understand that the roots of the military in our communities. Now, as a youth, as I mentioned at the introduction, you served in Vietnam, and we're seeing a lot of gente going overseas to fight against Iraq. Now, as a veteran, what is your assessment of our youth in the military, why they join, and why they get involved with us? I know you've also written about this as well.
Right. I think there's a number of different factors that lead our young people into the military. One is limited economic opportunity. That's been a pressure on our community for many, many decades. The other one is what I would call a kind of desire to assimilate for some of our people. They think that they need to prove that they're patriotic, that they're real Americans. And one easy way to do that is through military service. So there's a very strong impulse to assimilate through the military. The other factor has to do with traditional forms of masculinity. Some people in our community and in working class communities in general tend to think that you can't really be a man, so to speak, if you don't go in the military. And so there is a certain kind of machismo that has always been present in working class communities, and that's why you'll find a lot of raza in the Marine Corps, because they're supposed to be the baddest military branch of all. So all of these factors work to drive our people into the military, and I think the economic one is probably the most important.
But in addition to that, would you say that there's also been a lot of resistance, or at least a minimal amount of resistance to militarism? And I guess the rate that we're going into the military, I know you've written before about our high numbers, particularly in the Marines and a number of other armed services, we're definitely disproportionate to the general U.S. population.
Right. I think, again, because of the limited opportunities, this military service is seen as one way out of the barrio or wherever you're stuck or you feel like you're stuck. And this has always been the case going all the way back to the, 1848 and immediately afterwards, Mexicanos in Texas, Nuevo Mexico, California, who were dispossessed people at that time, having just been conquered by the United States. The ones who didn't go back to Mexico, many of them went in the U.S. military right away. I mean, it was the only way for them to survive, really, to have a regular income. And again, to show that they were assimilating into United States society. So that pressure goes way, way back. And as you know, we've served, Latinos have served in the U.S. Civil War, the War of 1898, going all the way through World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and now. And now our numbers are, again, very high. So all of these things work against us, if you will, at least from my point of view, because I think our youth need other opportunities. I'm not saying the military is not something for everyone. I'm just saying that we need to have other opportunities. And so there's always been our presence in the military, and as you say, there's always been resistance to going in the military.
What kind of organizing was going on? I know you've written a book about this, or have edited an anthology, rather, of experiences in organizing around anti-Vietnam War work. What types of things did you document? What types of things did you see as you were as a soldier as well as a writer later on down the line?
Well, as you know, in the Vietnam War period, there was a full-blown social movement that we call the Chicano Movement that was going on during that whole period. And so Chicano anti-war activities were closely tied to the entire movimiento. People like Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez in Colorado came out against the Vietnam War very early as 1966. Reyes Tijerina, who was a Tejano who became famous in New Mexico, came out early against the war in Vietnam also. But for the most part, our community was, again, not inclined to question U.S. foreign policy, especially when there was a Democrat president in the White House, such as Johnson. I think our community always had this loyalty to the Democratic Party. And so in the early years of the war, and remember this was a 10-year war or more, in the early part of the war in the late 60s, our community was still a little bit inclined to support what was happening. But as it became clear that that was basically an imperialist war, we had no business there to speak of, then the community started to protest what was the draft. And, you know, I think those of us who are over 35 certainly remember what the draft was. The draft put a lot of Chicanos in the military in disproportionate numbers and in combat units in disproportionate numbers. So the first acts of resistance had to do with the draft, and people started either refusing to go into the military when they were drafted and then started organizing around issues in the draft.
What type of risk did the movimiento individuals take, the leaders and the organizers take, when they began to originally take stances against the war? Right now, I think people see this large patriotism that goes on in the community, and it becomes a little bit intimidating. What types of risk, if you can put it back in a historical context, did people like Corky Gonzalez take when they started to speak out against the war? Obviously, the momentum began to build to change that, or the public opinion began to change a bit. But at the time, there was a considerable risk involved as a leader, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, these people took great risk, especially the young men who refused induction into the military when they were drafted. I'm thinking people of Ernesto Vigil from Denver, Rosalía Muñoz from Los Angeles, and many others who refused to go in the military. And for RASA youth to do that at that time was very daring. I mean, again, the community was still very aware of all of the military service on our part in World War II, the large number of Congressional Medal of Honor winners from that war, and the pride that a lot of the jefitos had in having served in the military. So for 18- and 19-year-old young RASA to say no, Charlie, I'm not going to go, that was a big, big risk. And a lot of them, I think, to this day, are living with the consequences of that. Rosalía Muñoz, for example, who's a friend of mine, I think is still in many ways haunted by that period, especially after what happened with the moratorium committee and that huge demonstration he helped organize in 1970.
For the youth who may be listening to this show and might not have heard a lot, we've talked a bit about the Chicano moratorium on this program, but could you break down exactly what happened for those who may be listening who might not be familiar with the organizing that happened? This was actually a huge march. You touched on it at the very beginning of this interview, but it was really an important moment in history that should never be forgotten.
Well, that's right. August 29th, 1970 is a very important date in Chicano history. The National Moratorium Committee was formed around 1969. The Brown Berets in Los Angeles got together with some other organizers. around the university, like Rosalía Muñoz, Ramsés Noriega, who had worked with César Chávez. So these people were skilled organizers. They started organizing against the draft, as I said, but by 1969, they were having marches against not only the draft, but the war itself. So in December of 69, they had their first march. Another one in February of 1970 produced a film, which they then took around the Southwest. They took, for example, a copy of the film to the second Denver Youth Conference in 1970 and started to recruit Raza to come to Los Angeles for August 1970. And that's how the big August 29th march took place. And delegations from all over the Southwest participated. As I think many of your listeners know, that demonstration turned into a police riot. We know that the law enforcement agencies were all present, the FBI, probably the CIA, and certainly the Los Angeles police were all intent on breaking up that demonstration. We have to remember that this was the first time that an ethnic working class community had come out this way against the war. I mean, there were other anti-war groups, but not in working class ethnic communities. So our people were the first ones who really took a stand. And the police riot wound up killing three people. One of them was a 15-year-old brown beret. Another one was just an innocent motorist who was driving by. And then the third one is Ruben Salazar, who was a famous journalist for the LA Times and also was a TV personality here in Southern California. So Ruben Salazar became a martyr on that day. And August 29th, again, is part of that legacy.
One of the things that I think is really critical that you mentioned was how the demands against the Vietnam War were tied in with the movimiento. Can you talk a little bit about the political perspective as well as the demands that the community developed around the Vietnam War and how those were very much tied in with the needs of the community?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the slogans from that period was that La Batalla está aquí, and our struggle is here at home. And it was clear to many people, and of course, the most famous person, I suppose, who made this argument was Martin Luther King Jr. in a speech he gave in 1967, that the more the government spent on this war in Southeast Asia, the less money was going to be available for all the needs of working-class people here in the United States. And Martin Luther King saw clearly that his push for civil rights was never going to be realized as long as the country was being drained in this, what I would call an imperialist war abroad. So the Chicano leaders saw that as well. Certainly Cesar Chavez saw that early on, although he was in a difficult position because as a union leader, was closely linked to the Democratic Party. His hands were tied in many ways until after 1968 when Nixon became president. But all of our leaders eventually came out against that war because they saw that domestically conditions for Raza were never going to get better with so much money pouring into the Pentagon and then being spilled out into the murder, really, of innocent Vietnamese people. And that, I think, is where the analogy to the present should be sought and should be looked for, because that is exactly what's going to happen again here if the country goes to war.
What happened to the momentum of the Vietnam community organizing that was happening in the barrio?
Well, I think, in my opinion, there's a lot of theories about why Moratorium Committee died out and why the Movimiento lost steam by 1972 or 3. My opinion is that the primary cause of that was police repression. It was state repression. We know now, we have the FBI documents that show the extent of a provocation, of infiltration, and we know with the Black Panthers that their leaders were even assassinated. But the moratorium committee was broken up, we know, by a provocateur who came in and split the leadership. And so after that, I think people either disappeared because things were too dangerous. We know some of the Brown Berets had to go to Mexico and hide, basically, because they were being threatened by the police department. And other folks got involved eventually in other issues. As the war began to wind down in 1973, 74, and officially ended in 1975, a lot of the activists from that period got into other issues, especially police brutality issues in the barrio, because that was still a big problem there, and still is, as you know. And others got into indigenous rights. Others got into educational reform. Some became teachers and professors. What you see with those people from that period is not what's called a big chill, where people just become conservative all of a sudden. To the contrary, I mean, I think Chicano activists became less conservative, more radical to a certain extent, and they took their politics into whatever profession they pursued.
Let's talk about the current war effort right now. Can you tell me, realistically, have conditions changed all that much since Vietnam to justify the current war effort that the Bush administration is trying to present to our community and trying to encourage our youth to enlist and fight against Iraq and all these quote-unquote terrorists and such?
Well, I think, you know, at one level, certainly since we're 30 years later, conditions are very, very different internationally. And in the last 2 years, I think the conditions domestically have changed a great deal, because since Bush became president, there's been a lurch to the right, to the conservative side of the spectrum, the likes of which I've never seen. I mean, even during the worst moments of Vietnam, you didn't have this extremely conservative Justice Department with Ashcroft, or Defense Department with Rumsfeld, or a kind of fundamentalist Christian group around the president like we have now. So that's very different. What's not so different, and what in many cases is actually worse, is conditions for working class Chicanos, Mexicanos in the barrio or in the neighborhoods where new immigrants come. You know, one thing that's very different now is that more Mexicano immigrants came here in the decade of the 1990s than in any other decade previous in the United States history. So we have a huge group now of first-generation and second-generation Mexicanos, with some Centroamericanos mixed in, but mainly Mexicanos. And that group is, in my opinion, the key group that we have to talk to. And actually, we should probably be talking in Spanish, because that's their language. But these are the folks who are very susceptible to military recruiters. They see military service as part of the American dream, part of the attempt to assimilate. You hear some of them say things like, "I want to show my gratitude for the opportunities that the United States has given me," and therefore they want their children to go in the military. And that's one of the most challenging things for us, I think, as Chicanos. In other words, those of us who have been here a long time, our families have been here, we were raised and educated here. We need to make our Mexicano primos and primas understand that they can contribute to this country without sacrificing their children, without necessarily going in the military, especially when the military is programmed to carry out these wars, which, in my opinion at least, in the opinion of many people, are not necessary.
Would you say that the people who have been here for just a few years are fighting the same battle regarding assimilation and regarding showing their patriotism that our grandparents fought?
Yes, I think they're reproducing that same cycle. For example, a lot of my students now are Mexicano identified. They don't know much about Chicano history. They don't know American popular culture, for example, very well. I mean, they're learning it because they've been here a while now, but they don't know it the way a second or third generation Chicano might. And they haven't experienced throughout their lifetime racism in the United States. So they are very much still linked to Mexico. And so these are the folks who are going to have to create their own modes of assimilation or resistance to assimilation. And that's very important, and I think many of them will do that. You do meet Mexicano parents here in San Diego and elsewhere who say, no way do I want my child in the military, because they understand the inherent risk in military service. It's not just about wearing a pretty uniform. It's about potentially losing your life. And some folks say, well, isn't that your duty as a citizen, and so on and so forth. And we say that what your duty is to have a kind of critical patriotism. You need to know what you're getting into. You need to know what Iraq is, where it is, what its history is, what the history of the United States is in the Middle East, and you need to know if you're willing to die for that. So those of us in our group called Project Llano, which is an anti-militarism group, basically say to kids, we're not telling you not to go in the military, but we're telling you to learn everything you can about what you're getting into, because potentially it's very dangerous. The military's mission is not education, which is what their publicity says, money for school and so on, but that's not their main mission. Their main mission is to carry out armed conflicts around the world. And right now with this Bush administration, it looks like we're going to be in one war after the other. It's not just about Iraq. It's about what comes after Iraq, Korea, Iran, and if you read their documents, this is what they have planned. So a lot of RAS are potentially headed for the combat zone, and that's very scary.
What type of resistance are you seeing to this growing militarism in our communities? What are Latinos saying that you talk to about the situation?
Well, it depends on where you go and what sector of our community. There is now, one of the other differences between the Vietnam period and ours is that you do now have what I would call a kind of Hispanic professional class. And these are folks who got the benefits of the Chicano movement. You know, they got into the university and so on, and now have very good jobs and are very identified with the status quo. So they're... I think they're very supportive, for the most part, of the current administration. There are others who see very clearly that this is not a direction that the United States should be going in, and that the further the United States moves in this kind of reactionary right-wing direction, the more suffering is going to come to RASA, whether it be abroad or here domestically, where the economy just will not support this kind of interventionism and social programs and education and health care. You know, our community has the highest high school dropout rate of any other community. We're being locked out of schools here in California. Certainly the elite schools are locking our students out, just as happened in Texas when affirmative action was abolished. Our community has very high percentages of uninsured people, no health care at all. And so the needs of the community simply can't possibly be met with the trillions of dollars going to the Pentagon, and now, if it takes place, and it looks like it will, going to a war in Iraq and then a prolonged occupation of Iraq, where we'll be there for many, many years, dumping millions, if not billions, of dollars into it.
What are going to be, in your opinion, the key political as well as strategic goals and objectives for a movement, particularly a RASA-based movement, focused around anti-war organizing to really grow, in your opinion?
Well, I think the word organizing is the key word, because it's not enough to simply have anti-war rallies and demonstrations, although those are important at this particular moment. But for the long term, assuming that the war in Iraq takes place, the military victory will probably be very quick. There's no way anyone can stand up to the U.S. military anywhere in the world right now. And then the occupation is established. The danger is that folks just go back to doing what they did before once that takes place. So the long-term challenge is to continue to organize, to take the momentum from this anti-war moment and start challenging, really, the structures of U.S. society that make great promises in terms of democracy and opportunities, but simply have not delivered them for our communities. And this goes way back. I would invoke the year 1848 as the beginning of all this. There are opportunities for a few, and you see a kind of Hispanic trophy class, you know, the ones who made it. You look at somebody like Judge Estrada, who, you know, is a token Hispanic that Bush is promoting for the court. And we can name many others. But for the great majority of our people, and again, the recent immigrants are the most interesting group to me because they're now all over the United States. They're not just in the Southwest they were the way they were in the Vietnam period. They're everywhere in the Deep South, in New York, you know, in the Midwest, in Chicago. Those folks just aren't going to be able to do as well as the American dream promises. So that's the long-term challenge, is to continue to organize around other issues. In many ways, the war issue is a diversion from what we should really be organizing about. And this reminds me of, you know, 1968, before Martin Luther King was assassinated, he had something called the Poor People's Campaign, and that was all about changing the economic structure of the United States and making it more fair and more just. And the Chicanos were right there with him planning that campaign. And after he was killed, they still went to Washington and made their demands. And that was Tijerina, Corky Gonzalez, and many others. I'm not saying the young people today need to imitate Corky Gonzalez and the people from 30, 35 years ago. That's not what they should do, because those folks had different historical conditions to work with. The youth today have to find their own issues, and I know they're doing it because I see it in my students, and then they need to organize around them. And I would argue that economic justice and educational justice and health care are all main issues that we should be talking about. And again, issues of immigration, the militarization of the border for those of us who are in the Southwest, abuses by INS, we know. Now, I just read a piece today about INS abuses in Arkansas, where there are many Raza now working in the poultry industry. So these are all issues that we need to continue to organize around beyond and after this war scare ends.
Can you give people a little bit of information about Project Llano?
Yes, Project Llano is a group of activists and military veterans here in San Diego. It was founded in 1985, and what we do is we go into the public school system in a variety of ways. Sometimes teachers invite us into the classroom. Sometimes we go to career fairs and career festivals that they have, and we talk to students about the realities of military life. You know, one of the biggest selling jobs in the United States, which is to say, you know, false propaganda, is what military recruiters put out. You can meet anyone in the military, and they'll tell you that what their recruiter told them turned out not to be true. Because recruiters are salespeople, and they have to meet quotas. And so they'll tell you pretty much anything you want to hear. So we go in there, and we don't tell folks not to go in the military. We just say, here is what you should know. Here's information you should have. Here's what the recruiter might say. And here's what will actually happen, because maybe the recruiter is exaggerating a little bit. Here's what you can do to stop recruiters from bothering you, because as the young people listening to us tonight know, once you're a senior in high school, you are bombarded, whether you're a Chicana or Chicano, man or woman, you will be bombarded by phone calls and what borders on harassment by military recruiters. They are very, very interested in Latinos, because we're going to be the biggest demographic pool of 18-year-olds for a long time into the future. So they have initiatives, the Army and the Navy especially, have initiatives to target Chicano youth and Latino youth. So we talk to students about alternatives. We talk to them about the dangers of military life, the racism that exists in the military, the fact that very, very few Chicanos make it to be officers. If you look at the Marine Corps right now, 97% of the Latino Marines are enlisted people. That is to say, they are in the most hazardous jobs. Only 3% are officers. So, again, we're serving disproportionately in the most hazardous positions. So Project Llano is basically what we call a counter-recruitment organization, and we've been active here in San Diego, which is, with the possible exception of San Antonio, the largest military base in the world. I mean, we're just surrounded by military bases here in San Diego.
We've got quite a few here in Texas as well. So
right, I know.
I feel where you're coming from. Can you tell people how to get in touch with Project Llano and how to get in touch with you if they're interested in touching base and dialoguing with you about the organizing that's going on there?
Well, Project Llano right now is not really seeking recruits or anything because we're very tied up in the anti-war activities. If folks would be interested, they could go to a website called Committee on Militarism and the Draft, and that's COMD, and that would give them information about that organization, which is linked to Project Llano. So again, that's Committee on Militarism and the Draft, COMD. If you go to any search engine, you'll find that on the web, and then you'll be able to contact Project Llano.
Wonderful. Any final comments that you'd like to share with anybody, with everyone who's listening, or any other thoughts that you'd like to impart to them?
Well, I'd just like to say to all the Raza youth listening to us tonight that please try to get information about what's happening in the world. Don't believe necessarily what TV news tells you, because TV news is probably the most reactionary TV news we've ever had in this country right now. And make sure you know what's happening. If you know people who are thinking about going in the military, whether they're your siblings or primos or whatever, put them in touch with people who have been in the military. And even your own parents might tell you, you know, this isn't the thing we want you to do. We'd rather have you go to college. We'd rather have you try to get a good job, training. And, and if you decide to go in the military anyway, well, that's your decision. But at least it'll be an informed decision, and you won't get caught up in something that you're going to regret later in life. Remember that the military will put you in a position to act against the values you were raised with. You may wind up being in a position where you have to kill people. Now, you know, it might be self-defense or it might not, but that's the great danger, and we would just want you to be well-informed about what you're getting into.
We have been speaking tonight with Jorge Mariscal of the University of California, San Diego. He has been talking this evening about Project Llano, talking about militarism, talking about what is going on in our communities and the struggles which are facing our youth today. Jorge, I want to say thank you very, very much for talking with us this evening.
Okay, gracias, un placer.
Thank you very much. And stay tuned. We will be back in just a moment.